You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
So we're going to get started. Hi, everybody. My name is Justin Vase. I'm the Director of Research for the Center and the U.S. And Europe here at Brookings. And it's really my pleasure to welcome all of you this afternoon at Brookings for a conference on the ongoing, unfortunately, Eurozone crisis. Allowing the destruction of the euro is to take the risk of the destruction of Europe. Those who destroy Europe and the euro will bear responsibility for resurgence of conflict and division on our continent. These are the words of French President Nicolas Sarkozy just yesterday, sort of dramatically raising the stakes of the upcoming summit of the ECOFIN Council and the Eurogroup, the European summit that will happen on Sunday, October 23rd. But today, just a couple of hours ago, President Sarkozy flew to Frankfurt for an emergency meeting with the leading players of that crisis, namely German Chancellor Angela Merkel, European Central Bank President Jean-Claude Trichet, as well as Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, and a couple of other leaders, as the French and the Germans apparently remain at odds over the comprehensive package of measures that is supposed to be presented and agreed upon on Sunday. Our aim today in the conference is to go beyond the headlines and try to take a step back and make sense of the Eurozone crisis, its origins, its actors, its mechanisms, and its impact on America. We will also try to discuss, that's the hard part, what the most likely scenario for the future is. I would add that today's conference is really a Brookings-wide initiative with, you know, basically two parts of Brookings collaborating, economic studies with my colleague Doug Elliott on the one hand, and foreign policy studies with Carlo Bastasin and myself for the Center in the U.S. and Europe. And, you know, obviously we didn't want this to be purely endogamous, so we extended the invitation to our friend and colleague Ted Truman from the Peterson Institute, whom I'll introduce at greater length in just a moment. I would add that Brookings has already produced other things on the Eurozone crisis, publications by Carlo, by Doug, also by Domenico Lombardi and a couple of others, and they are now all gathered on the same page, a specific dedicated page on the Brookings website. And also, this conference is really the first in a series that we're planning. So the second one will be just 2 weeks from now at the same place, at the same time, on Wednesday, November 2nd. You can mark your calendars already. And the theme of that second conference will be the European Central Bank and the new role that it has assumed during the Eurozone crisis. And, of course, the occasion will be the changing of the guard of the president from Jean-Claude Trichet to Mario Draghi on November 1st, just the day before. So that's Wednesday, November 2nd. And then there will be a third conference on the Eurozone crisis, probably in early December, but we've not decided yet. And we'll see if there's still a Eurozone to talk about. No, it's a joke. I will now briefly introduce our speakers. We have three very qualified speakers, and I will very briefly introduce them in the order in which they will speak because they have a lot to say, and I'm sure you have many questions. Doug Elliott was an investment banker for two decades, principally at J.P. Morgan. He was also president and principal researcher for the Center on Federal Financial Institutions, which was a think tank that he headed. At Brookings, he focuses on issues surrounding both public and private financial institution, and he has been working quite a bit on the Eurozone crisis in the recent month, including regulatory reform, the role of the banks, and other important issues. Carlo Bastasin is a non-resident senior fellow at the Center in the U.S. and Europe and in the Global Economy and Development Program here at Brookings. He's an editorialist for Il Sole 24 Ore, the Italian business newspaper. He's a specialist of the European political economy. And I would add he's putting the finishing touches on a book entitled Saving Europe, How National Politics Nearly Destroyed the Euro, which will be published by our own Brookings Press in early 2012, a couple of months from now. And it's a sort of an insider account of the Eurozone crisis starting in 2008, for which he got extraordinary access to the main policymakers, European policymakers in Germany, in France, and elsewhere. And I must say, because I've had the privilege to read it, that it's a sort of breathtaking narrative mixed with great economic analysis. Now that the commercial is done, I'll move to Ted Truman. Ted Truman, no, but I sincerely recommend the book in advance. Ted Truman is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics just across the street from here, and he's been working there since 2001 after serving as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for International Affairs from 1998 to 2001. Previously, he directed the Division of International Finance of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System from 1977 to 1998. And I would add that from 83 to 98, he was one of the three economists on the staff of the Federal Open Market Committee. And he will offer remarks after Doug and Carlo. So, Doug, why don't you start?
Thank you all for coming here today. I'm going to do the easy part of this, which is to try to give an overview of what the euro crisis is, how it came about, what the key issues are that we'll face. And I'll leave the really hard stuff to the two qualified people who are up here. I know Justin almost said there were only two of us qualified. And I'm sure I know which two. But so let me start. What do at least I mean when I talk about the euro crisis? I'd say the principal attributes of that crisis are we're talking about a sharply increased risk of default for at least a set of the Eurozone countries. That results in a number of risks to the banking systems in the Eurozone, which, as with almost all countries, are heavily invested in bonds of their own sovereign. There's also related to this what I think is a small probability, but a probability of one or more countries leaving the euro. Any of these things, defaults or movement out of the euro, has potential severe knock-on effects in the eurozone and, of course, beyond the eurozone. I'd also add, on a medium to longer-term basis, the euro crisis is also about the implications of competitive imbalances within the eurozone, the difficulties that Greece, for example, has if you think of it kind of as a business in the modern world. Now, why do we care, particularly here in America? Well, Europe is likely to have a severe recession if things go badly wrong. In the worst cases, I am certain they would go into quite a severe recession. It would create a host of political problems within Europe, and the recession over there would certainly translate to a recession here, and probably a significant slowdown of growth in China. They'd probably go from, say, 9% growth a year to 5% growth a year, but given that they're designed for much higher growth, they'd have their own problems out of this. And the financial markets would be hurt very badly across the world. We've already seen intimations of this in the way the U.S. and other world stock markets have gone down substantially at times when the euro crisis was most scary. Well, what caused the euro crisis? Again, I have the benefit of speaking just at a very high level here. But it's a complicated mix of economic, political, and market confidence factors. It's not any one. It's a combination of all. Starting with the political, the economic, the Eurozone's design was inherently flawed. This was fairly well known at the time. I would venture to say most of the founders were aware to at least some extent, but felt that there would be opportunities to correct the known flaws along the way without the kind of pain that we're in fact going through. Currency unions only really work if the countries are very similar or if they closely integrate in order to be able to handle things as one unit. But politics prevented close integration at the beginning, and politics are still preventing, making it difficult to create much more integration now. though some progress has clearly been made. One of the underlying political issues, on which I think most people would agree, is that Europe, in quotes with a capital E, the European project, has been an elite project for the most part. Governments, academics, business leaders, people at the top of society have been very strongly supportive of the European project in general, whereas the mass of the public in many countries have had their doubts. Germany's probably at one extreme in that respect, in that while the Germans certainly entered willingly into the Eurozone, much of the public was very reluctant to give up the Deutschmark because of worries of the type of thing, for example, that is happening now. And so part of what this has meant, the difference between the desires of the people at the top and the general wariness of much of the public, is that politicians have gotten to the point where I would argue in places like Germany, they're faced with a choice of being executed by hanging or by firing squad. And the choice really is they can do things to bring greater integration of the Eurozone, but that are things that are very unpopular and lose the election that way, or they can go the other way of losing the election and let the Eurozone fall apart, which I would argue is almost certain to produce a fairly severe recession, which is also not an easy way to get reelected. Now, if you face politicians or really anybody else with two choices, both of which are unacceptable, they will search rather desperately for a third choice. And in this case, what it's tended to mean is that we've had partial solutions. So each time that we've had a phase in the crisis, what we've had is first denial, then a gradual acceptance that this really is a crisis that isn't going to go away, and then the governments at the last possible moment have done the least they can do to still deal with the crisis. And politically, that's probably been the smart thing, though not necessarily, but it certainly isn't the way to get to the right long-term answer. And since what's happened is each time the crisis has come back, because they haven't dealt effectively with the totality of the problem, it just gets harder and harder. I also mentioned market confidence. Let me underline the importance of that. It wasn't that many years ago that the market foolishly felt that there was no reason to distinguish the creditworthiness of the different Eurozone countries. There were very modest differences in price, but not much. The assumption, I think, A, was nothing terrible was going to happen in the world, and B, if something did happen in the Eurozone, the whole Eurozone would be behind whatever country was troubled. The market has swung to the opposite point of view now. The market has quite possibly overshot, but in any event, it certainly does not have great confidence that the European leaders will do what's necessary. Now, to underline that this is market confidence issue, look at Japan. I'm not an expert on Japan, but the debt ratio there is something over 200%. You're talking about very high levels of debt, and yet everyone is quite confident that the Japanese will continue to be able to pay their bills, and you really have not seen issues with them. So market confidence does matter. It can take a bad situation and make it worse. It can take a bad situation and make it easier to deal with it. Now, how do we solve the crisis? Obviously, if I knew all the answers, I would probably be somewhere else and not talking to you now. But I do believe there are some broad themes of what would have to be true for the answers to work. First, I believe from the investor side, and not everyone agrees with me, I believe the investors are reaching the point where they will demand what are effectively cross guarantees. They will need to know that the resources of the entire Eurozone are behind Italy or Spain or whatever individual sovereign that they're looking to buy the bonds of, because they're no longer comfortable that the kind of informal guarantees, camaraderie, whatever you want to call it, will hold. Now, there are multiple ways this could end up being done. You could have so-called Euro bonds that are effectively guaranteed joint and several liability for the whole Eurozone. You could have the European Central Bank doing massive interventions that effectively put the resources of the whole zone in there. You could have some version of the various stabilization mechanisms that have been created that could borrow from the ECB or have independent resources that provide the funding. There are multiple ways of doing it, but I think investors are going to demand ultimately that the Eurozone stand behind its members or say it's not going to, in which case I think things will get far worse. In exchange for that, should that happen, strong countries will very certainly demand strict constraints on the fiscal policies of the weak. And one of the difficulties in figuring out how to make these solutions work is that part, figuring out how to have the quid pro quo, the tight fiscal integration, the careful constraints. I also think that politicians, based on voter desires, will demand that private sector investors who have chosen to buy these bonds do take losses, not just in Greece, where that will pretty clearly happen, but in other cases as well, that they share in the burden. Part of what that will mean is that the banks in the Eurozone will need shoring up, and there are steps, I think, that will be taken shortly to try to prepare for that. Many of the critical things I'm describing are very complicated and from a legal point of view, particularly the way the Eurozone is set up and would often require treaty changes. So there are a lot of complications here. But so let me just end by saying that while I believe that things will get significantly worse before they get better, I do believe we'll get to the point where the governments do what they will ultimately have to do. I think the odds are fairly high that the crisis will be solved without a disaster scenario, by which I mean widespread defaults or countries pulling out of the Eurozone. The reasons that I think this will happen is there's a very strong political will to keep the European project working, and there's quite compelling economics. Now that they're in the Eurozone, backing out would be fairly disastrous. Having said all that, let me be clear. I personally think there's maybe a 1 in 4 chance of a quite bad outcome. I'm not trying to say there aren't risks here. The problem is we need many, many, many things to go right. And each of the things has a very low probability of not going right, but there are so many of them, you get to an appreciable total risk. So thank you. Let me turn it over to Carlo.
Thanks. Thanks, Doug. That was great. While Carlo is transitioning to the podium, I will say to the people at the very end, there are about 20 seats here in the front, so please stand up and come here in the front while Carlo is getting ready, because you're certainly not very comfortable. So please come here, and we feel quite lonely here in the podium. And I will thank Doug very much for his remarks, which I interpret as seeing the euro crisis, I mean, the current pain, as being sort of birth pangs rather than death throes, right, of a different eurozone probably, but which is seeing life in a very painful way. So while we let the other, the last participant seat, we'll turn over the floor to Carlo. Carlo?
So good evening, everybody, and thanks to Doug for the important remarks he put forward. You see the difference of perspective. If he knew all the answers, he would probably be intellectually satisfied. If I knew all the answers, I would still be stuck in the euro area crisis as an Italian. So, well, let me say from the first, as far as the broad question which gets raised time and again about the survival of the euro, let me say from the outset that I'm pretty convinced that the euro will survive this crisis. And the reason why is basically that the backbone of the project, which is the political will of governments and of the European public opinion, is probably stronger now than 6, 12, or 24 months ago. The European Statistical Office has produced a set of polls on the attitude of the public opinion, showing that almost 90% of the European citizens are in favor of stronger coordination as a solution to the crisis, as opposed to national solutions. And even one of the crucial observations that Doug advanced about the attitude of the German citizens shows that the hypothetical return to the Deutschmark is now envisaged by a declining share of the population, a share which has been declining even during the crisis. So still the crisis is extremely dramatic. One way to see it is by comparing the euro area situation with the U.S. Because in principle, if you would look at the figures and the fiscal position of the U.S., you would see that the deficit in this country is higher than in any country in the euro area. In the euro area, and the debt would rank as the second highest in the euro area. Still, all the attention is focused on the euro and not on the dollar, and there are several and serious reasons for that. The first can be found watching the debt composition of the debt in the euro area and in the U.S. Basically, the share of private investors in the U.S. debt is limited to a share of 14%, 14%, while the relative figure, the equivalent figure for the euro area, ranges from 46 to 67. It's 48 in Italy, it's 66.2 in France. Evidently, private investors are a very fickle category of investors who tend to run very rapidly, optimizing in the short term the balance between risk and reward, while public investors tend to be steady hands have an intrinsic interest in keeping in holding the status quo. That's probably why when Standard & Poor's downgrades the U.S., not much seems to happen, while when it downgrades Spain or France, only envisaging that, or Italy or Greece, the whole euro area seems to crumble down. Those investors can very rapidly shift from one of the euro area country to the other without having currency cost, without changing the profile of currency risks. By doing that, they produce a problem in the provision of liquidity that the country of concern is facing. Obviously, there is no national central bank which can compensate for the liquidity shortage, and in a very rapid time, this liquidity problem can turn into a solvency problem. So basically, that would explain, would be a way to explain the crisis in terms of the relative youth of the currency. The euro is a relative young currency, has not established its credibility among the steady hand investors. This is also mirrored by the share of the debt which is held by central banks. The share in the U.S. debt is around 36%, 18% directly by the Federal Reserve. In the U.K., the Bank of England holds 20% of the British public debt. In the euro area, the share of the European Central Bank, even after the securities market program, is probably less than 4%. But this brings the second structural weakness in the euro area, which is the lack of a central bank which is offering a consistent provision of liquidity to the single states. Well, it is being intentionally conceived. So actually, as you know, at the end, the European Central Bank steps in when the crisis threatened to slip out of control, but it does that reluctantly, following a strategy that a monetary economist would brand as constructive ambiguity. Actually, when markets get nervous and risk aversion increases, there is nothing constructive in this ambiguity, unfortunately. And that leads to a third structural point, which signs a difference between the euro area and the US, which is obviously the lack of a well-defined and legitimated political responsibility behind the euro area. As we know, the EMU, the European Monetary Union, was conceived in this way as having a monetary policy centralized and decentralized fiscal policies. And why that? Well, first of all, because the European Union is a treaty-based institution. It's based on a set of rules, which is both supranational and intergovernmental. And the reason to keep the intergovernmental side well alive was based on the fact that there was no taxation at common European level, and evidently the responsibility for fiscal policy necessarily had to rest on the national governments. But a rules-based system works not well during period of good weather, but it works pretty badly when the weather turns bad. And the exceptional circumstances after the global crisis were indeed very bad weather. So the crisis affected immediately banks, as we have heard, but banking regulation, for the same reason as fiscal policy, remained under control of national authorities. So the banking problems transferred into public debts, which assumed specific national differences and enhanced the divergences inside the euro area. And the reason why there is a national control on the banking system is basically because of political interests. Banks have a very special role in the European economy, different from the role that they have in the US. Well, it was even more difficult to reconcile everything under a political common commitment because of a well, we could say a philosophical pillar of the European Union, which is based on an organizing principle which is called the subsidiarity. Subsidiarity is a category which is derived from the Catholic tradition of decentralizing the decision, taking them at the level, taking at the central level only the decision which cannot be taken at least at an equivalent, with equivalent effectiveness at a decentralized level. But evidently, once you have this organizing principle of decentralization, to bring back the competencies, you need a crisis. And that is exactly what is going on, an effort to re-centralize some competencies which had been left to the national state. So we are now in front of a very decisive weekend. On Sunday, there will be a EU Council summit which should provide for a new comprehensive solution. And if we connect the dots of the problems that we have been describing, well, the solution would be simple. You need to have this ECB to provide the liquidity as a backstop for the national states' problem, and the national states commit to fiscal union. But all this is farther down the path. We are still far from that. To reach fiscal union, we will have to set up the institutional framework for that, change the treaties, and that will take years. In the meanwhile, we are left with a rather timid arrangement. Probably the ECB will keep on purchasing stressed government securities, and what is the likely outcome of the summit will be not the ECB buying the stressed securities, but basically governments setting up a system for insuring investors against losses that they may incur investing in government securities. It's all too slow burner stuff, probably, but that will keep alive the two methods that have characterized this crisis. On the monetary policy, it was constructive ambiguity, as we have seen, that is not to compromise too much the ECB. But on the political side, it will be its equivalent, which I call the policy of uncertainty. The policy of uncertainty is a kind of two-pronged strategy that has been supported by the German government, especially in the absence of a common political authority. The only way to manage and to enforce discipline in other countries was, on the one hand, to ensure the firm commitment of Germany and of creditor countries on the euro, and on the other hand, to leave it to the markets to enforce the discipline in the other states. There was, by the way, no ready political authority to employ for this aim, and so markets played this role. It is a very dangerous strategy, and we have seen it. But paradoxically, it is actually working with governments. Fiscal policies are very much in line with the German requests. Everybody is making all that is possible to reduce the fiscal deficits in their countries, even in Greece. It is still to be proved that it is enough to please the markets, and we will probably see starting from Monday. But as I said, eventually, the political determination is there, and I can reasonably see that countries will bend over backwards to defend their currency, having seen the problems that they would face without it. Thank you.
Thanks, Carlo. Ted?
Well, thank you. I guess speaking from someone who comes from across the street as well as across the pond relative to Europe, it's a pleasure to be here and collaborate. I've been reminded recently of the attitudes in the late 1990s when the Europeans were coming to create the final steps of putting the euro in place. And they complained that we in the United States were not taking the whole project very seriously, on the one hand, or were saying that it would fail, on the other. Today, at least you can say on the first point that the Europeans complained that they were not paying attention to their problems, their activities anymore. And it may well be true that some of the Euroscepticism may have been warranted. So I'll too have a few words to say on the past, present, and future. I think it's easier just rather than to comment on things just to make sort of summarize my points, which I think largely be complementary, not entirely. So the past, I think, the two points that I would re-emphasize would be that the incompleteness has been emphasized by others, the incompleteness of the euro construction institutionally on the one hand, essentially a currency without a government, and in terms of public opinion, in the sense that the general public did not, they thought that this was going to be win-win for everybody all the time, all benefits and no costs in the project. That has proved not to be the case. I see in terms of the crisis, this again will be a slightly different take, but not, I think, orthogonal to what you've already heard, four basic elements. And I'm thinking more in a sort of narrow crisis mode, which is where I worked, unfortunately, most of my time. The financial crisis in the euro area, which started in some sense with the global financial crisis, that it affected some eurozone EU non-eurozone EU countries, and then it affected Greece a couple of years ago, almost 2 years ago now, and it spread to a number of other countries. And I think, in retrospect, one would say that if people had acted decisively. And more decisively in May of 2010, we wouldn't be where we are today. But each country is different, But they're each similar in the sense that they need to stabilize their economies, their financial systems, and their public finances. And I think this is an important point that may have been, I don't think, disagreed with around here, but underemphasized in terms of they need to start growing. And you're worrying about debt ratios, you have to worry about the denominator as well as the numerator. Second, there needs to be a creation of what's called a firewall to, with respect to the rest of the Eurozone. That involves financial support from institutions like the ECB, at least temporarily, various mechanisms like the European Financial Stability Facility alongside the IMF. There is the risk that these structures that are now there, and I think that's all they have to play with at the moment, are insufficient to the multiple tasks that have been put before it. And this is one of the reasons why you find this talk about leveraging the ESFF, and Carlo just mentioned the insurance, using to insure debt issuance as one possibility. Third, you have, that's been mentioned, the banking and financial system. In some sense, Doug's the resident expert on that, on this panel on that one. But the basic issue is that if banks are going to take large losses, the question is whether they can absorb those losses and remain solvent. The answer is no, or at least we aren't sure. And that aspect of it has, in turn, affected decisions by the European authorities because they don't want to go down that road and find out what would happen. And the problem is it may be this may be the most negative point on the panel you've heard so far. It may be too late to act effectively on that point. And then lastly, you have the part of the crisis, the sort of existential crisis in terms of the euro and the eurozone, addressing the incomplete institutional structure and re-educating the public about what's required to make it work. The problem, basically, is it's difficult to reconstruct a structure when it's under attack, right? To rebuild a house when it's on fire, right? To repair the leaking roof when it's raining. Choose your own analogy. Therefore, there are implications for short-term crisis management, because decisions are taken, in some sense, in the crisis context, in the view that are colored by the nature of the longer-term debate and their various feedback effects there about issues of moral hazard, how much you share sovereignty, how you generate the public support. So for the future, I see sort of – I mean, I'm going to give you my version of the three basic scenarios. I think there is 25%. I think that was basically what Doug said, took him down right, that there will be a full-blown crisis. Not enough will be, you know, in some sense that the structure will not work. Or it takes too long to do the kinds of things that need to be done, and therefore the whole system breaks down. And in many ways this can happen, whether it can be the Greeks balking, failing, quitting, right, or similar political failures elsewhere, or the political processes that fail to put in place the economic elements that are needed in time to stop the rot, or run on financial institutions, or run on the euro. And depending on how serious that full-blown crisis is, you know, above 6 on the Richter scale, if you want to put it that way, or 7, 8, or 9, right, you could have ultimately a fragmentation and breakup of the Eurozone. And I think that's possible. Lastly, the second is the sort of the other extreme is the comprehensive solution, 25%. That might be involve a nicely debt restructuring for at least Greece, probably Ireland, maybe some other countries, at least partially in those countries, continued financial support for the ongoing fiscal adjustments and structural reforms in the countries under crisis, a well-constructed firewall for other countries using the ESFF and the ECB in some combination. And I think something that hasn't been mentioned, economic policy actions, regular conventional economic policy actions in the ECB. They can lower their interest rates 150 basis points and get down to the, where the rest of the world is. They're going to have an important question before them about whether they, not just whether they take fiscal support actions if they're in the go into recession, but whether they allow their automatic stabilizers to have a take effect, which are very powerful in Europe. You have the need for creating a safety net for financial institutions. I have this gut feeling, which may be wrong, that we're too far gone for just garden variety capital injections. And if you really get a crisis, you're going to have essentially a Eurozone solution that involves, in some sense, ring-fencing the retail operations of banks and then doing a triage about who should succeed and not succeed without using the principle of we support our banks, not your banks, which is essentially how the system works now. And then you'll have to have, and this is an important component, a commitment to reconstruct the economic governance structure. And I think this is the point that sometimes, in my view, is missed. If you're going to have institutions like the ECB and even some political processes building a bridge over this crisis to something else, there has to be something on the other end of the bridge. And the problem, I think, as seen from speaking as a former central banker, though not for the ECB, of course, the other pier of the bridge has never been there or hasn't been there yet, and so they are unwilling to walk off on the out on that plank, right, and dip up down into the water. And that reconstruction is going to involve, I think it's been hinted at, mentioned already, treaty revisions and constitutional changes. That will take time, but you need some commitment, I think, to get there. Most likely near-term scenario is you're going to have muddling through. The Sunday announcements will be not be as decisive as some people think and hope and wish. It'll be another step along what the Germans are calling a long path with many twists and turns. But it seems to me as I think about it, and I think that's the implication for the inference I draw from the other two members of the panel as well, ultimately they're going to end up having to deal with the four elements of the so-called comprehensive solution. Right? The question is how long is it going to take them to get there and how much broken crockery there is along the way. It's clear that along the way you're going to have slow growth in Europe with adverse effects on the rest of the world. That's one of the reasons why the United States is so unhappy about all this. And you will have further negative feedback loops through the financial system, both within Europe and within the rest of the world as a whole. I mean, it is remarkable to see the extent to which you've had financial markets and general risk aversion, which is centered on what's going on in Europe, affecting other financial markets, just not just here, but in other emerging markets, starting essentially in the middle of the latter part of the summer. I think part of this is a projection of 2008 and 2009 onto the market. I don't think history usually repeats itself quite so rapidly. But the point is that is driving investors and their concerns, and that's, I think, the reason why all this is so important and why, as I sometimes have put it, when the U.S. policy authorities say what are the principal international economic policies that are issues that are faced by the world today, the first, the second, the third, and the fourth are Europe. Thank you.
Thanks, Ted. One of the aims of this series of conferences is to sort of give you an overview of the crisis. We'll do it next time, 2 weeks from now, with the ECB. But right now, we're focusing on the sort of the big picture. And so, I have three questions for our panelists after their introductory remarks. And maybe I'll start with you, Doug. I'm really struck at the fact that this crisis is a sovereign debt crisis, sort of entangled in a banking crisis, in the context of either recession in the past year or very slow growth in Europe. And it seems to me that if we had just one of the three, it would be, I would say, relatively easy to solve. If we had two of the three, it would be conceivable to resolve two of these problems, slow growth and banking crisis, or, you know, banking crisis and sovereign in the context of high growth. But the three at the same time seem to me to make a particularly big challenge. And so could you address that question on the relationship between the crisis and slow growth, and in particular the worry that, of course, the measures that are taken by governments throughout Europe to reduce their deficit will simply kill growth, making the crisis probably more acute than it is now?
Certainly. It's a good point, and one that Ted was referencing as well. There is a close relationship between growth prospects and the depth of the debt crisis, of the euro crisis. If growth rates in Europe were expected to be higher, markets wouldn't be as worried, people wouldn't be as worried in general. It would be possible to sort of work your way through the problem over time. So the absence of that higher growth is an issue. If we could get towards higher growth, it would help. The second aspect, which Justin just referred to, is unfortunately many of the actions to deal with the debt are going to make growth slower. So cutting back on the amount of government spending or raising taxes, either one generally slows growth. So the things you need to do in the first instance to deal with the debt is going to slow the growth and make the debt more onerous. So there's a negative feedback effect here. And certainly we've been seeing it with Greece. Greece has actually done an awful lot to pull its deficits down, but it's also put its country naturally into a fairly serious recession in doing so, which has made it harder to reach those targets. I'd also like to mention the tie-in with the banking system in terms of this. Something I worry about a great deal. In general, I do support putting more capital into the European banks quickly, which probably means that the governments will have to mandate it and, in fact, supply some of that capital. So I do overall support it. But what I'm really afraid of is it will be done in a way that gives the banks a strong incentive to reduce that new capital by shrinking. Because the way that bank capital is normally calculated, the adequacy of the capital, is by comparing the amount of capital to the size of the organization or to the size of the risks. And so if you're BNP Paribas, for example, or Societe Generale, or any of the large European banks, and you want to reduce the amount of capital you're going to have to take on, and the reason you'd want to is because it'll come on very bad terms, either from the market or from the governments. If you want to take less of it, you want to be smaller. Well, if the banks in Europe basically cut back on loans and try to sell the things that they own, you're going to have a lot of pressure on the economy. So, yes, I do worry that if done badly, this could severely crimp growth in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Maybe to continue on the banking crisis, because that's one aspect that is probably less well known than the sovereign debt crisis. You know, generally the narrative about the Eurozone crisis is that it all started when there was a new government in Greece 2 years ago in October 2009, and it discovered that the deficit was way higher than what the previous government had had announced, and that sort of set off then the euro crisis in general. So the question, Carlo, was: so when did the banking crisis start to be linked with the sovereign debt crisis? And so was it part of the origin of this eurozone crisis? And then now, how do they relate to one another?
Well, it's a very good question and a crucial one. You're right. So generally, the knee-jerk reaction to such a question would be the euro crisis was originated in 2010 or October 2009. Well, actually, the first connection between the first reaction of the CDS, the credit default swaps on sovereign debt of a euro area, showed in October 2008, it was the case of Ireland, which was bailing out its six largest institutions, credit institutions, but by doing so, providing public guarantees, it created a tension on its public debt, and the CDS in Ireland started to react. Similar reaction started to propagate soon afterwards, and for the simple reason, since banking resolutions were of national nature, were delegated to the national authorities, they impacted directly on national fiscal policies and on the level of national debts. So depending on the gravity of the banking problems, immediately the public debt situation differentiated among the countries, and investors were observing them not anymore as the euro area as a whole, as we say, but as a single object of investments. And it was the case in January 2009 when some auction of government securities started to fail, not to obtain a full subscription. And it was the first case since years in the euro area.
Interesting. Ted, I have a question on the U.S. side of all of this. What can the U.S. do now? The U.S. seems in a position to, to be mostly a receiver of bad news, but can it do something to help solve the crisis? Can the Fed act, for example, to help either European banks or the European Central Bank? Can the federal government do something, and should it do something?
Well, start at the end of your question. The Federal Reserve has, in fact, has acted to reopen its swap lines with the European central banks, and actually starting in May of 2010. So, at the time the first Greek rescue was announced, they reestablished the swap lines, and has been recently announced. By the Europeans, the ECB and the Bank of England, or I think that's all mostly cover, are reinstituting dollar liquidity provision activities that extend for a year or 13 months, so through the end of over into 2013. So in that sense, the Federal Reserve has acted. That's the one thing they can do, if you want to put it that way. They have done to take some of the dollar liquidity pressures off of some of the European banks, using the credit standing of the ECB as their counterparty, rather than having to worry about the credit standing of the individual European central banks. Something I might also add that is not particularly popular among American politicians of both the right and the left. So that's one thing that can be done and has been done and can be done on greater scale and should be done on greater scale. On the sort of fundamental questions about sort of the United States doesn't have any overt leverage over these matters. It has... It can coax and cajole, and it can share experience and ideas, which has been done. The Secretary of the Treasury went to Poland in early September, if I remember my dates correctly. It's all a little bit of a blur at this point. I should have put it the other way around. He actually accepted an invitation of long standing to go to Poland to meet with the European central bank finance ministers and central bank governors in an informal meeting to share both U.S. concerns and some ideas about how one could try to address those concerns in terms of the proposals, some of the ideas that the mechanisms that we used during the crisis. And the principle, other than expressing the view that you have to do, I think there are two basic points. One is there's a tendency to use two different phrases, to do whatever it takes to save the euro or the euro area, right? And then sometimes you hear it translated as do whatever is necessary. Well, doing whatever is necessary is a sort of a defensive posture, right? Doing whatever it takes is trying to get out in front of the problem, right? And this administration, and I certainly share that view, is of the view that overwhelming force, both on the policy side and on the financial side, is a necessary component of a solution. So that's part of the message. And then the more technical part of the message is that there are ways, especially when you're limited politically and financially, of trying to scale up your resources, and that's where you get this debate about leveraging the ESFF involved, and that is something that we face many of the same problems in the depths of the crisis. The Congress first voted down and finally voted for the TARP, so the administration, both the Bush administration and the incoming Obama administration, had a fixed kitty to actually do things with, and the question was how to leverage that to do as much as possible. And one way to do that was to combine that as, put it crudely, equity, with financing that came from the Federal Reserve. But with the losses taken on the equity side, at least in the first instance, to have much more firepower. Because, at least the way I think about this, is the market is using leverage against them. And in some sense, if we, speaking as a former government official, if we, the governments, all have to appropriate every euro or every dollar that we use, and the markets can leverage, right, every dollar and every euro, we are operating with one hand or two hands to hide behind our backs. So the idea is to sort of have some countervailing force, which you leverage with the balance sheet of the ECB or with some combination of mechanisms, of which there are large rights, and the equity of the EFFS. There may be a few other things around, but not, those are the most likely ones, to have some sense that you can convince the markets that you will have enough firepower to sustain the financial program. I think, but beyond expressions of concern and advice, and I think it's fair to say mobilizing international public opinion, which includes the G20 broadly, the United States doesn't have any choice but to sit there and hope they get better because it's affecting us.
Thanks, Ted. I would like now to turn it to the four. We have a full half an hour for questions and answers. So there's a mic over there. You know the ground rules, but I'll mention them anyway. Please stand up. Please identify yourself and make sure there's a question mark at the end of your sentence. Sir, here in the middle. And I would add that we will take three questions in a row, and we'll take advantage of Doug being with us again for 15 minutes. He has a commitment afterwards to direct many questions to him before then turning to Ted and Carlo. Sir.
So my name is Anthony Odi. I'm a consultant for the World Bank. The general agreement that coming out of this, we want to see some kind of European constraint over national fiscal policies. Question is, would the panelists like to explore what types of form those constraints might take? We tried Maastricht. It was arguably a bit crude, a bit inflexible. Nonetheless, if we had backed it, we would have been in a better place than we are today. What might Maastricht 2 look like? What are the options? What are the pros and cons?
Thanks. In the back over there, Michael.
Michael Callingard from Brookings. Question picking up a little bit on what Doug said about Greece. Is the international community, meaning basically the Europeans at this point, being too harsh on Greece, and is there a danger that Greece will find itself in a position where it simply can't fight its way out, both in terms of political problems demonstrations and the like, and more generally the feeling among lots of groups that they're being treated inequitably, and then just being able to pay back. Related to that, what are the prospects for default in one form or another, and is that manageable?
Thanks, Michael. And then we'll take one last question in the back. The sir with a white shirt just in front of you, Tessam. Yep, sir.
Hi, Eric Shatlands. Basically, my question has to do with looking at the ECB, and you look at an organization or an institution, I would say, that has generally been focused on price stability. And so when you look at this and we talk about what the ECB has done, what it could be doing, and kind of those shortcomings, whether that be interest rates or whether that be backing liquidity of different nations, what perhaps institutional reforms can we look at to force ECB almost to be proactive or to at least be active?
Thanks. Dave, do you want to take a first cut at least one of these questions?
Sure. I'll touch on two of them probably. In terms of Greece, I don't know enough about the Greek situation to have a strong judgment, other than to say there seems to be a clear consensus among the Europeans that the package has to be reworked, that Greece at the moment under the July agreement is being pushed harder than it can actually handle, which is why this weekend they'll probably end up announcing some things that will be more haircuts on the debt and presumably some other actions to make it a little more feasible for Greece to make the adjustments. In following up on Greece, in terms of the ability to handle a default, that's a really important question because at one level, it's possible to treat Greeks separately because I think almost everyone accepts that at least quantitatively, Greece is significantly different from the other troubled countries. So it's at least possible to say, here's what we do for them. Mm-hmm. That's not what we're going to do for everybody else. The problem is it may be in degree significantly different, but many of the types of problems that it has are shared to some extent by Italy or Portugal or some of the other countries. And so investors aren't going to necessarily have a certainty that just because the Europeans say we're going to do this with Greek investors, but we're going to protect everybody else, that's really how it's going to work out in terms of that. In terms of the kind of Maastricht II stuff, I'll leave that to my two colleagues who are a lot smarter with it. In terms of the ECB, in the short term anyway, I think the ECB is analogous to the way the Fed was in the financial crisis we went through. It was the place that actually has the money. So it has a much greater ability to provide funds without having to get treaty changes or national parliament approval or whatever. So even though it will come, if it is significantly more active in supporting the efforts, which I think it's going to have to be, it's going to hit a lot of opposition. But right now, at least, a simple majority vote of the members of the ECB board can take very wide-ranging actions. So I think they'll end up doing a lot in some manner to take funds and provide it, whether that's buying many more bonds on the secondary market or it's leveraging up one of these other instruments like the EFSF or whatever.
Thanks. Carlo, would you like to?
Yes, sure. I would pick up a few remarks on Greece. Basically, what's gone wrong with Greece? Well, we had the experience of the Eastern European countries, which recovered from the worst recession. In relative terms, it was worse than in the old European Union, without changing the level of their currency to the euro, so acting practically as a euro area country. And they recovered amazingly rapidly in a matter of less than 2 years. And basically, probably we had this experience in mind when we thought that Greece could perform an equivalent recovery once shielded by the worst turbulences. Unfortunately, the structural peculiarity of Greece was overlooked, and I give you just one simple figure. On average, the euro area industry receive 65% of their profits from abroad, mostly from the rest of the euro area, the European Union. Greece receives collects 85% of its profits domestically. So when you produce domestic deflation, you cut wages and you cut prices, inevitably you reduce the propension to invest and you produce a recession which spins out of control. Essentially, the category of a closed small economy relative to open small economies was the important one to consider, and it was not considered. So now we know that to restructure Greece will take much longer than any other country in the euro area. It will take 10 years, probably longer, and Greece has to be shielded, has to be provided with funding for this period without musing over a new access to the markets of the country. As far as the ECB is concerned, it's obviously, well, there is a basic principle which has to change. We are still focused on central banking based on monetary stability because that was a critical experience in the European history and especially in Germany, which gave shape to the monetary union. We're now confronted with a different category, which is financial stability. Financial stability is by itself a concept which requires interdependence, and this changes the frame of mind of policymakers.
Mm. Ted, would you like to add something?
Well, I feel the modest obligation to answer the first question since the other two have ducked it. And I don't have an answer, but I do. I think the answer is going to involve some variation on the theme of a European fiscal authority, right? But it really is, you know, down the road, right? A European fiscal authority that can issue its own obligations, whether or not you call those euro bonds. I mean, they could be called euro bonds, right? That's one way to do it, and you use that, right? Has some disciplines that it can apply, maybe because it has expenditure powers as well as revenue raising powers to apply to different members. So that gives you some incentive system, and if it's in the business of financing things, right, it has an independent capacity to raise revenues. So it has the capacity to, for example, I'm just talking off the top of my slightly empty head, it has the capacity to, you know, say, okay, 1 percentage point of VAT taxation receipts that come from the euro area as a whole. We had this small problem about the euro area versus the European Union, but let's talk about the euro area as a whole, is now going to be devoted to paying off this debt, right? Which is a way of essentially taxing the system as a whole to achieve common objectives, which is in some sense the way federal systems operate. So I think you're going to have to come to some structure. Now, the question is whether it's a minimalist structure, but it has to be beyond, it seems to me, the Stability and Growth Pact, six-pack approach to of surveillance plus not very many incentives, mostly disincentives in order to get there. I guess the only comment I would make on the ECB point is, and I don't disagree with what's been said, I also don't think that a pursuit of price stability has been what's been holding back the ECB from doing other things in the other area. That's not saying that I think they were wise to raise interest rates this summer, right? Or in 2008 for that matter, or I don't think, and I do think they would be wise to lower their interest rates today, and that presumably is partly a function of the inflation concern. But I don't think it's been, that aspect has been the problem that they have had in using other tools to address the crisis. In some sense, they have too sharply differentiated between the two things. Right, so they say we run monetary policy, conventional monetary policy, to drive stability, and we do unconventional things to deal with the crisis. Right, and in a way, one would hope that they maybe would spend a little bit, do a little bit more on the former, right? Because there is some feedback effect. Just to use it, so macroprudential policy is not just worrying about stability of the financial system and the fact that and doing things so it doesn't collapse. It actually involves using macro policy to reinforce the financial system. And they basically have declined to use macro policy as much as they could make it softer so that you have a less of a recession in Europe because interest rates are lower. So that component of macro prudential policy, I think, hasn't been there. On the other hand, it's been outside of the complete discussion of this whole topic since in the last 3 years, so they probably could be excused.
Thanks. Second run of question here in the front, sir.
Thank you. I'm Peter Kurovsky. I have a question. During the whole time the Greek debt was buildup occurred, the banks were authorized or had to have against Greek bank lending only 1.6% in capital, which means that they were authorized to leverage their capital over 60 times to one lending into Greece. Obviously, it's mind-boggling, the general idea, but how can you explain that at this particular moment, when just because they discovered that they shouldn't have done it, that they're still pursuing strengthening the capital requirements in, let's say, the most inadequate moment for that? Raising the capital requirements right now when the banks don't have capital and you allow them to 60 to 1 and now you want to bring them down to 20 to 1, it's sort of the most...
Thanks. Yeah, it's a great question. The gentleman behind you.
Hi, I'm Joe Prendergast with the Federal Housing Finance Agency. I definitely just trying to relate the different parts of the crisis together, like we've been talking. So I definitely see the large systemic risk to a Greek default. But trying to think of it in terms of the currency union, do people on the panel think a default would necessitate Greece leaving the union? And if, from an economic, I guess, rather than a political perspective, would that be that catastrophic if one of the peripheral countries left the currency union? And sort of how does that relate to defaults is what I'm getting at. Thanks.
Thanks. The lady here, green.
Hello, good evening. My name is Jana Gritter-Sova. I'm a faculty at University of California and visiting fellow here at the site, John Hopkins. So Mr. Truman already alluded to the fact how American economies were skeptical, with regards to the euro project at the beginning, mainly because the euro zone did not satisfy the criteria for optimal currency area. And so we all know that the degree of financial and trade integration was not what Mandel prescribed. And over time, we've seen decreased degree of financial trade integration, but we still see European economies exhibiting very different structural characteristics. And so we still see this persistent north-south divide. Nordic countries being mainly export-oriented and I would say fiscally more responsible versus southern countries, less fiscal responsible and probably less also export-oriented and benefiting from the cheap money due to high credibility of the euro vis-a-vis, drachma, et cetera, et cetera. So despite all these prescribed solutions you alluded to, all three of you, although, the third speaker has left already, I'm just wondering if we really can, or if the European leaders can come out with a long-term, somehow sustainable solution given this persisting divide in the Eurozone? And can we somehow take the lessons from the failed currency unions, such as Scandinavian currency union, Latin currency unions? So can we, can we really expect that this this comprehensive project will be achieved, given the last week negative vote of Slovakia with regards to bailouts?
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks. Ted, would you like to start?
Well, the first and the last, second and the third questions, in some sense, I think are related. The second half of the second question. So do I think that default, do I personally think the default would lead to departure from the Eurozone? I think the answer is no. I mean, it could be, it depends on the political circumstances, how that comes about. So if the political processes in Greece, to take that example, say, we don't want to pay and we want out, right? And the only government that can be elected in Greece is one that delivers on those two things, then they're out, right? But as a technical matter, you could have a, as that's why I put it in my remarks, a nicely write-down, substantial write-down on Greek sovereign debt without having them pull out on the, having Greece pull out of the Eurozone. I do think that if Greece were to pull out of the Eurozone in a, even in a sort of negotiated way, which is hard even to imagine, but let's put the, out of the Eurozone, out of the Euro area, go into essentially the European, whatever the economic area arrangement, say, it would be, I don't want to present, there are no such thing as sure things, but it would not be, it would... I think the possibility of a sequence of events that led to a fragmentation of a moving backward of the European project and all its integration aspects would be much more highly probable than I see it today, and if not absolutely likely. You would end up with increased barriers to trade and capital movements and people movements and so forth and so on, and a lot of the integration type projects which are underway and have been underway for decades would, I think, grind to a halt and some discrepant go into reverse. And that comes to your question about, well, it was never doable to begin with or advisable to begin with because these economies are sufficiently different. I think, I may be being a bit of a Pollyannish. I'm not sure the economists have done a really good job when speaking as an economist and talking about, oh, it's an optimal currency area and so forth and so on. I mean, if you think about the United States, it's hard to convince yourself from an abstract sense that this is an optimal currency area. Especially since the different parts of the country have, right, many of the characteristics that you describe about Europe, whether it's about the economic structure of the United States, of various parts of the United States, or the profligate tendencies, right, or the poverty, or the income and poverty distinctions, are very much prevalent within the United States. So I don't see that as much of a problem as the fact that the political superstructure was not there, so that when the system came under stress, right, there was, if I put it that way, even less capacity than there is here in the United States, and we know full well that there's not a lot of capacity here within the United States to reach a solution, a political solution. You did not have the political structures, right, that to complement the ECB. So you have, for example, right, the ECB doesn't have a finance ministry to interlocute with, right? In a crisis, if the central bank and the finance ministry are not, they don't have to be identical. If they're not on the same page, if they can't talk to each other about how the problem is going every day, right, so that they know as they move their various levers, right, that they know whether they're complementing each other or not, right, then you have a problem. And I think that has been the basic problem within Europe in terms of the incompleteness of raise. On the first question about, I mean, there are two issues there. One is, what's the risk weight you put on sovereigns? That clearly is political, right? So if you're part of the Eurozone, you get the same sovereign risk as you in Germany as you do in France, as Belgium, including Greece. That clearly was politically, you had to do it. Second part of your question is this the right time to raise capital? I think Doug, in some sense, answered that question. I mean, if you raise capital, or the way it's now being put, if you raise capital and you think about it, or maybe you did it, Carlo, in terms of the ratio, right, you can raise the numerator or you can reduce the denominator, right? Reducing the denominator is probably not what should happen, right? So the point is, if the Europeans are going to, so instead of, the inference that I think you draw is, instead of saying you should have, go from 6 to 10, let's say, right? What you need to do is you need to go from capital for your given risk-weighted assets, right, which are 6, so the 10 for your current risk-weighted assets, right? At least in the current risk-weighted assets. So you actually are adding to capital rather than reducing exposures or reallocating exposures.
Carlo?
Well, I fully agree. Starting from the question on raising capital in the banks, I think it's not the right moment. It's not the intention of most European countries, by the way. It was raised, well, evidently they have a problem on the asset side, and it has to be solved politically, as Ted has explained. And on the liability side, we have seen hidden problems as well, and it was mainly the IMF pointing them out, because there was a kind of reluctance, especially in Germany and France. If you see the Global Financial Stability Report of the IMF, there is an amazing graph where it points out how slow they were, Germany and France, to correct the low level of capital. They are really standing out of the rest of the group. So some pressure is reasonable. It's not the right moment. It has to be. It's an issue that has to be tackled in a more reasonable range of time. As far as Greece is concerned, I attach a probability slightly lower than zero that Greece goes out of the euro area. But just have a question. Would you invest in Greece after it's out of the euro area? You need to reintroduce capital controls, first of all, and think that during the crisis, just in the last 2 years, 200 billion of euros have flown out of the country, mainly fruit of tax evasion, that have tried to find a shelter in Switzerland. Would they come back, outside the euro area, in a different set of rules and laws? I don't think they would. So the only way is staying in and react. That's a very short answer on a complicated question, which I may have not grasped fully. But just an example. Optimal currency area are not in the category of optimality as idealists may characterize it, nor is fiscal federalism. They are the brainchild of human beings and full of failures and so on. In Germany, since 60 years, fiscal federalism is characterized by a constant stream of money transferred from three regions, to the rest of the country. And in the U.S., I guess it's similar, like five states providing for the bulk of the transfer to the 47 rest. So some imperfection in human constructions has to be accepted, I guess.
Thanks. We'll take just two last questions, and we'll ask the panelists to respond very briefly, the gentleman here and then the gentleman in the back, and then we'll call it for a close. So the gentleman here first. Yes.
Alex Brutero with German TV N24. My question goes, again, you touched upon the subjects and what the IMF has said about the German and the French banks. And the question is, since this is not only a sovereign debt crisis, but also a banking crisis, at least at the European level, do we have a far too big banking sector in Europe, and the weaknesses of the banking sector in Europe has never been addressed? And you raised the question about capital levels, for instance, in France and in Germany since the crisis in 2008.
That's a good question. Sir?
I'm Klaus Nehring from UC Davis. I have a question which I would like to put in terms of a counterfactual. If in, let's say, end of the 1990s, just before the Eurozone was established, if in a crystal ball one could have forecast the coming, under the current setup, the coming scenario, how the mismatch, whether strain on the mismatch between, pointing out the mismatch between the monetary union and the lack of a fiscal union. And then if one could have gotten, there was some statement from Mr. Truman, I think, that people in general were quite aware of that, but they didn't take it seriously. Let's say they had taken it seriously. There was, what would the reasonable choice or would or should have been? On the one hand, to say, okay, no, the Eurozone is unworkable, number one, or number two, seems to crystallize, okay, no, we would have had not just a monetary union, but also a fiscal union. We would have to have both. My question is, would there be, is there a reasonable, a good case now? Would there have been a convincing case then to argue, where in that case, where we should have done everything, we should have gone for a fiscal union, and there would have been support in a broad set of countries for that.
Thanks. Maybe, Carlo, you'd like to start, and we'll have to give very, very short answers.
Yes. I like both questions very much. Well, the first one, my opinion is there is a reasonable case for dividing commercial banks and investment sectors. And after having done that, we may discuss if commercial banks are still too big to fail or so on. I don't think so. It's manageable. The crucial case is, the crucial point is putting together financial supervision, because what is being really disappointed, it was the financial supervision in some countries. The second question, well, let me just say, if the Stability Growth Pact had it been respected honestly since its outset, we wouldn't be in this situation. And what happened in 2003 shows not only in fiscal profligacy in other countries. 2003, the year when the Stability Pact was violated by Germany and France with the active cooperation of the Italian presidency of the European Union. Well, after that moment, other imbalances show in the graph. Even increasing wage costs in Greece or in Italy or in Spain, there was a set off of indiscipline which went beyond fiscal policy. So honesty or checks and balances are inescapable, whichever the institutional solution will be.
Thanks. Ted, last word?
I'm not sure. I guess I agree with broadly with what you said on the banking system. One has the sense that, partly because you're talking about national banking systems, that they're, which are probably too large for the countries, right? That collectively they're too large for the euro area, right? And they're concentrated within the countries, and in some sense you need more diversification and so forth and so on. So in that sense, I would agree with that. I think on the question of the crystal ball question, except for your qualification, my reading of the debates within Europe was that some people looked into the crystal ball, including some Germans, to be quite frank, like Otmar Issing, right, and said, this is incomplete, right? In a governance sense and in an economic governance sense, right? And if we go down this route, the notion that in some sense time will take care of it, I think that was the image you used, right? Time will take care of it. They said, well, I'm not so sure that we'll be able to adjust as we go forward. So there certainly was, including within a large fraction of Germany, which is a legion example of you, that you had to actually have political union, much more in the way of political union, which wasn't broadly acceptable within Germany at that time. But I think the thoughtful component of the – thoughtful is probably my little pejorative at this point – component of the elite actually saw that that was the logical consequence, right? Now, you had this qualification that had to be supported, right? But I think, again, the answer would have been, there are two answers. One would have been either don't do it, right? Don't go ahead. Or go ahead as was preferred with a very narrow defined group, right? So you don't make the choices that were made, essentially the political choices, to start with the Eurozone, which was as large as it was. You still would probably have troubles because you would have the 2003 fiscal problems, but you compounded the size, compounded with the sort of thumbing of the nose to the structures, right, I think helped to lay the groundwork for the subsequent indiscipline. But fundamentally, it's easy, which is easy to say, by the way, in retrospect, that the failure to build a stronger structure, governance structure, more political integration or more support for political integration, I think, is part of what the problem is today. And that's part of the problem why, you know, you have to go through 17 parliaments in order to get this done and that sort of thing done and so forth and so on. And that is a painful process, even by painful U.S. political standards. It's like having 17 houses of parliament rather than only two.
Thanks very much. On this comparison, I think we'll call it a close. And please join me in thanking the panelists, which have been great.